you've got the need to podcast. This is episode 37, Edge of Tomorrow from 2014. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And with us tonight, Mike, we have someone who I remembered he was on The Burbs, and I couldn't remember if he had been on Cruise Club or not yet. And I looked back, and he was indeed on Cruise Club, a movie that you love that I'm not quite fond of. Not that I dislike it. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. Our last guest, this was his favorite Cruise movie.
Wait, what was the movie he was on before? You're leaving me high and dry. I can't remember.
Interview with a Vampire.
Oh, yes. Lestat.
Lestat.
My main man.
Was Matt Delhauer's favorite Tom Cruise movie. With us tonight, we have Nick Jenkins. Hello, Nick.
Hi, how's everybody doing in these weird times?
Oh, very well. I mean, as well as we could be doing. You know. We have crazy ramped up production on these because we were alternating these with the Tom Hanks episodes, but because we are so near the end, they are both weekly now. So also, as this comes out on Friday, May 8th, also out today is The Terminal, which we already recorded, which is a weird, weird movie.
Yes, very strange little flick there.
Okay, well, before we get into Edge of Tomorrow, which I don't want to offer any spoilers, but I think we all absolutely love and adore, let me give a quick, and this is not going to be quick because they're never quick,
it's
because
never
all
quick.
Of Tom Cruise's movies are all like wildly complex. So Nick, we have a joke here, like kind of a running joke on the show. I do a plot summary, sort of kind of like your 60-second plot dump that you used to do on Real Bad, but not timed. And I do it for the Cruise movies, and Mike does it for the Hanks movies. And so the Cruise movies are all like these wildly complex sci-fi, high theory,
super
whatever
convoluted
movies.
Yeah.
And then Hanks is like, yeah, he's stuck in an airport.
Right? Yeah, like he falls in love on the phone. All right.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for the... You know, thanks for getting my back here. So, okay, here is what Edge of Tomorrow is about. I write this down as I watch the movie, and then I condense it. And so this is the condensed version, and I apologize that it's already long. Okay, aliens called Mimics land on Earth and conquer most of Europe. So we form the United Defense Force, the UDF, to combat them and finally get a win at Verdun. Tom Cruise plays Major William Bill Cage, no relation, media relations for the Army. Against his will, he's forced to join the UDF and is demoted to private. He's sent to war. He kills a blue alien, which we find out is called an alpha, but dies. He wakes up back at the base, but remembers dying. He remembers everything. Keeps happening. As he keeps dying, he gets better at predicting and avoiding his deaths. He meets back up with Emily Blunt, who's sort of in and out of the movie. She had what he has. She has him find her. She plays Rita Brataski, who is the Angel of Verdun. She is kind of the face of the war effort. She is this war hero. We won the Battle of Verdun because they let us win. And so this whole Operation Downfall, this like human effort to like, we're going to eradicate them. It's going to be the surprise effort. It's sort of like D-Day. It's all a trap. They're going to kill us. But we learn that by Cruise killing that blue mimic in the first life, what's called the Alpha, it gave him control of the Omega's ability, the head alien, to reset the day and effectively win every battle by being able to replay it over and over again like a video game. So then we see them train for combat. Every time that he comes back to life, everyone forgets everything except for him. So he has sort of develops a shortcut with Emily Blunt to remind her or let her know that he knows exactly what she had because she had it before. Cruise has visions of where the Omega is. They explore. Eventually, they steal a device that lets Cruise tap into the Omega to find its position. The issue is that he gets attacked and given a blood transfusion, which loses his reset power. Eventually, they hire or they recruit the platoon that Cruise was stuck with in the beginning of the movie. They fight to the Omega. Cruise blows it up and dies, but he's coded in the Alpha and the Omega blood. So once more, he wakes up on a helicopter this time as a major, not as a private. The mimics have sort of backed down. He finds Rita. Things are different, but also exactly the same. She greets him very icily, and all he can do is laugh.
Good job.
That's the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
It's basically Groundhog Day meets...
Independence Day?
Okay.
Yeah.
It's Ground Dependence Day.
The Groundhog Day mechanism, story, like plot device, has kind of been played out. However, it has created two of my absolute favorite movies of the last 10 years, this movie and Happy Death Day. Like, those two movies, I think, are absolutely wonderful. I also really like Before I Fall.
It's
the Zoe Dutch movie.
The ones you mentioned are the only ones I'm aware of, and it's funny how it can kind of, you could do one per genre, it seems, and then it goes away a little bit, you know? And they're all, like, these, like, perfect little examples of how to use this technique in screenwriting. It's crazy.
Well, Russian Doll did it, too, on Netflix.
Oh, I have not watched. I'm sorry.
which is good. It's not as good, but I feel like it's maybe it's not played out, but it feels like, oh, it's another Groundhog Day thing. But like sometimes it just, it works. And I think you're right, Mike. It's like the one time per genre thing, whether it's horror, whether it's this action, sci-fi, alien invasion, when you do it right, it's like, okay, we can never do that again. Like that's like, they did it. It's perfect and it's done.
Yeah, but you could say that after Groundhog Day as well.
Sure. Yeah.
You could say that, but you know, I think it's great. I think like, I don't think there is a perfect slasher, for instance, you know, which is basically a subgenre of horror, right? You could say there are lots of great examples of it. And I think that we have that here. I think we have lots of great examples of this being used well. And come to think of it, though, I don't, at least off the top of my head, I don't know if I've seen a real bad one.
Groundhog Day effect in movies. I feel like I had a conversation with my friends.
It's interesting because, you know, when this movie came out, I was kind of like, oh, it's hanging itself on the Groundhog Day thing again. Like this, I can't see this really going too well. And I watched it. I was like, wow, I like this more than Groundhog's Day. I think part of it was crushing my expectations of it being able to work twice. And then with Happy Death Day being like, oh my gosh, like this can kind of keep working as long as you just like are clever enough or smart enough or like don't try and control it too much and just let it play out.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And it was interesting to me too, because like I love Groundhog Day. I think it's an incredible, almost one of those perfect films that is going around Twitter right now. I would say that Groundhog Day is up there. And so I had the exact same reaction that Mike did, was like, oh, it's Groundhog Day, but it's sci-fi. But I mean, for me, sci-fi is always like, that's the hook that gets me in. And I'm sure we'll talk about this later, but like this film didn't perform really well and it was in and out of theaters before I even realized it.
Yeah, even had a title change and everything like that.
I wish, this is one of those movies I wish I'd been able to have seen on the big screen.
I almost certainly did, but I don't remember for sure if I did or not. Oh. But I think like it came out in the era, I want to say it came out in the era of MoviePass, which means that I would have seen it.
I remember going to like not like one of the better theaters to see this. I think it because like Nick said, it was sort of like not, it was underperforming, you know, especially for, I think, for a Tom Cruise like alien, you know, war kind of film, like a summer blockbuster. But I remember seeing it at like kind of the rundown theater and it played like incredibly. Everyone was like sort of shocked as to like, wait a second, like, what am I watching?
Oh, I did see it. I saw it in IMAX 3D apparently on June 5th, 2014.
Oh God, 3D would give me a aneurysm with this movie.
Yeah, I don't remember that. I mean, that's also, it was like 3 weeks after Godzilla in IMAX 3D. I feel like this movie and that Godzilla movie, which I also love, have a lot of kind of visual and aesthetic similarities. I think that was a great early summer blockbuster season for surreal sci-fi, sort of.
I know this has like inspiration from a manga comic, and I'm definitely feeling it. And I also got that, obviously, Godzilla being, you know, like a Japanese property, and so it didn't come from manga, but like they sort of share some kind of bond, I feel, visually and aesthetically as well. So
it is based on the manga All You Need Is Kill, which was written by Hiroshi Sakurazaka. There's a lot of the IMDb trivia, which I got rid of a lot of it, was about the similarities and the differences to the source material. And one thing, that stood out to me is I was comparing this, you know, because Mike, I know that you love Happy Death Day. Nick, have you seen Happy Death Day? Do you like it? Have you not seen it? Do you not like it?
I have seen it, and I do love it.
Wonderful. Okay. So you know how in that movie, every time Tree wakes up, she like feels, I mean, Cruz also feels the pain of his death. Like, he remembers dying, right? But, like, in that movie, sort of spoiler, kind of, as it goes on, she goes to the doctor, and he's like, what is going on with your body? Like, she takes, like, an x-ray or whatever. He's like, I don't know what, like, it looks like you've been stabbed, like, whatever. Like, you know, she has, like, this accumulation right. of injuries, even though her body physically, on the outside, appears normal. I was like, it's weird to me that Cruz does not suffer that, it seems. Like, it seems like he wakes up in pain, and then things kind of reset. But apparently, in the comics, the Cage character, as he goes on, he starts developing, like, worse and worse headaches, which I guess is kind of, like, a nice little thing. But I think the bigger point I'm trying to make here is that I like that it's kind of streamlined in a way. Like, as sort of jarring as it is to me that that's not included here, the fact that this movie's an hour 53, I was like, that's, it feels like it should be so much longer. It could be, but the fact that it's so, like, condensed, I was like, oh, this is, I think this is another reason why this movie is so great.
I think there are a couple things to look at with this. Like, it's a science fiction twist, right? Like, regardless of the alien part, like, this, the Groundhog Day twist is like a sci-fi twist. It's something you could put into a Twilight Zone and would feel completely at home in a Twilight Zone. I think one of the things that Happy Death Day did that I really appreciated was that that hitch that she's kind of slowly dying. Like she, like her body can't yes. take this. And with Groundhog Day and with, geez, I just want to keep calling it Live, Die, Repeat, Edge of Tomorrow, it's a mental thing. So when he's waking up, I don't think he's waking up in pain. He's waking up scared usually. Like the jolt
okay,
has.
That's fair.
Something about the jolt, whether he's been shot or whether he's, you know, was hit by a truck or whatever, it wakes him up like he's waking up out of a nightmare. And I think there are different ways that you can do that. And I love that we are getting different things like that. Like the conceit in Happy Death Day is wonderful, that it's slowly killing her, because it gives you an end or a yes, climax yeah. that you're going to, or a ticking clock almost.
Which this movie does in a different way, which is smart.
Absolutely. And so I think, yeah, getting clever writers to take this idea and then do something a little bit different with it is really great. And I like that it's just a mental thing in here, because it made me question things throughout the movie. You don't want to have answers for in a sci-fi thriller like this. You don't need all the answers. It doesn't have to logically work every time, because like theoretically, muscle memory wouldn't work. You're not training. Those muscles have now been untrained from
it's
what
it's a real matrix situation. Like, why do my eyelids hurt? Because you've never used them before.
Exactly. So like things like that, like you don't want to know, but it did. I was like pleasantly thinking about it, like, oh, so mentally he's going through it. So he's remembering these things, but he's still the same strength that he was. Like, he's not building muscles. And I don't know, just a lot of interesting stuff to just sort of marvel at. But it doesn't matter that it can't be answered or it wouldn't work or whatever. It's still such a thoroughly enjoyable story. That conceit of waking up again and again and again until you get it right. Ah, it's so great. And it does it this time without... I know I love Groundhog Day, but I also hate the character of Phil. Because you're supposed to. He's supposed to be just a royal jackass.
Right.
It's weird to see Tom Cruise playing such a sort of a nebbish guy. Like he's afraid of things. He's not really a hero by anyone's standard. And to see
him real quick, that's why Doug Liman, the director, wanted to do this movie, is because he said you finally saw Tom Cruise bad at something. Like, this is such an opposite, like an antithetical Tom Cruise of what we've seen, because this is not him. Like, it's him, but it's not him.
It's so great, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's terrific. And I buy him instantly as this sort of squirmy coward right off the bat, too. And, you know, there's a lot of ground to cover here without dealing with things like, you know, Joey, like, you know, physical internal trauma and stuff. But they do manage to deal with it as like a mental trauma, you know, like this.
Yes.
I buy every turn this character makes beat for beat throughout this film. It's like written all over his face by the end of the movie, you know. And I don't know, I attribute some of like the questionable stuff just to part of the alien powers, you know, like his incredible acute memory that he suddenly developed, you know, and being able to like memorize days and days and days and all this kind of information and things. But I mean, it's just an incredibly streamlined and like economic, you know, script and story, the way it plays out, as much as they need to cover. And I give him a lot of credit for not doing something that I think, as much as I love and it works in Happy Death Day and Groundhog Day, like those movies seem to cover more of the day every day. And this does a great job of showing like important days and like, right. you know, the training, learning about the Omega. It's very cool how it decides to like spend its time on what it wants to repeat and repeat.
Well, I think that's what's really a big difference to your point. A big difference between this movie and Happy Death Day is, like, I feel like in Happy Death Day, we see every time Tree dies. And I think to a certain point, she's just like, I'm going to have fun, right? Like, I'm going to walk through school naked. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. Like, whatever. I'm going to die. There's nothing I can do about it, right? And then as things go on, she starts, like, becoming physically affected by it and has to, like, be smarter about it. And, like, sort of at the end here in a similar way, when he gets a blood transfusion, he's like, okay, now it matters, right? My favorite moment in this entire movie is when he first has the first conversation with Emily Blunt, and he like tackles her and he's like, we need to get off the beach. And you see him, without looking, shoot up and kill a mimic and then rocket to his left without looking and kill another mimic. And I'm like, that is so fucking cool. Like, it's so cool. The fact that they reset this probably hundreds, if not thousands of times, like they never really mention. There's, I think, like one maybe reference to like a time span, but not really. Like, he's done this so many times that we're not seeing, and he's dying over and over again, and he's living the entire night where he has to go through boot camp, and he has to wake up, and he has to drop and deploy on the beach, and he has to find Emily Blunt, and like, you know, he's probably not doing everything up to that point perfectly, so he's like, it's just, it's gotta be so frustrating. But this movie, to your point, Mike, jumping to where it matters and when it matters, it's like, oh, this is the right way to do it. Like, maybe a movie hasn't done it the wrong way, but like, this is indisputably, I think, the right way to do this.
I don't disagree.
And I also think, cool, good, I'm glad. I also think that like, it's not you know, Nick, you were saying about it's not muscle memory. I think he's essentially learning a dance. Like, they're learning a ballet. Like, it's an action ballet, right? Like, you know, when he's like, step left, duck right, and she's like, step left, she's like, trying to remember. Like, it's a dance. It's a choreographed dance.
You said something earlier about, like, it kind of being like a video game. And lately, I've been watching a lot of speed running during the quarantine because, like, those guys are just, it's all like, you know, you just memorize the whole game. Like, it's beyond muscle memory. It's just like, some of these guys do shit with their eyes closed. It's just mind-boggling and stuff, and so like,
well, you can watch blind speed runs, like people do play the games with their eyes closed.
Yeah, and there's almost like moments in this movie where, you know, he could like do, he does, right? He fights the one guy at night in the rain with his eyes closed, right? So you know, like, more to your point.
And then when they're at the end, they're stealing the thing from the general's office. We don't see it more than once. We see it, like, they've probably done it a dozen or more times, but it's like the step forward, okay, now step back, now get in the elevator, now get out of the elevator before and go in the room back. Like, it's like this very choreographed thing. Like, it's almost like Splinter Cell, right? Like, it's just like, I can't be seen by the guards and whatever. It's beautiful. It's a beautifully shot and like well, like laid out and choreographed and orchestrated scene.
It is. And it to go back to a point that you were making before about the speed runs, I remember there were times I would play video games against people who were like that, and they would actually caution me and say, look, this is not going to be any fun for you. And I'm like, what do you mean? And they were like, well, because it's not about playing the game. It's about timing things. Mm-hmm. So you're moving faster than, you're actually moving faster than the frame rate to be able to make these characters do this, this, and this. So it's not so much that I'm playing against you as much as I'm hacking the system while you're playing. It starts to kind of become that with him even, that it's like he's not really living the day or playing the day most of the time. He's just sort of like 15 steps ahead of everybody else. So that's why he doesn't care most of the time. And it was, so I really wanted to hit on that. This feels like a video game, because when you play something over and over and over in a video game, I don't know about you guys, but I don't usually write stuff down. Occasionally I will, especially if it's like a long RPG. But generally, it's like, okay, I got to remember that this mutant's arm is coming from this side, and then I've got to duck for that and roll for this and then go into my inventory, you know, stuff like that. That's legitimately how it played in here. So I don't know, maybe it's an accidental relatability.
Maybe because, and I think, Mike, you might have been saying this earlier, like the interconnectivity or interconnectedness between like video games and Japanese culture and anime, and then to your point, RPGs, like, it all kind of feels like this is of a world and of a type of storytelling and world building, that it feels like a video game almost, because, like, this kind of feels in a similar way you're saying about Godzilla, or we were talking about Godzilla before. This also feels like Pacific Rim, right? Like, it's the same kind of, like, it's the mechs versus unknown aliens, and that's, you know, essentially a video game. Like, that's a kind of a VR game, an AR game, whatever, where you're in the mechs, right? Like, it's all the same kind of, like, they look like video game aliens because they kind of are. Like, it's the same, it's all the same brain.
It's cool, too, because, like, the way they moved is almost like a, like, it's missing some frames of animation or something, the way, like, it would, like, pixels would jump on screen or something. And I don't know if any of this, I mean, some of it has to have been, they've obviously, like, were like, oh, look what we've maybe stumbled upon, let's explore this a little. But none of it feels like in my face in a way that like another movie would make it the whole conceit, where it's like, look how much this is like playing a game. And especially since like video games themselves are so much like movies now. But I definitely think there's got to be a correlation between, you know, the time and place that the original source material was developed, you know, i.e. Japan, which is like huge gaming society, you know, and it coming from manga and all that kind of thing. Like, there has to be something there, absolutely. And and I'm glad that it's not like the only thing going on in this movie. Like, that's what's so cool about it too, is like there's other things to like look into and pick apart here.
There's so many good character things in this movie, some of which don't really go anywhere, but I still like them. A lot of J-Squad doesn't really go anywhere, but I like all of those people. I like them from the moment they're on screen. Then in the same thing with Cruz's character, like I immediately want to know what happens to him, like, as he goes through. And part of that is just there is a charisma about Tom Cruise. He is very good at locking you in as an actor and taking over the screen. That is not something you can really train, right? Like, it's just a big part of who he is. But good God, Emily Blunt in this.
Oh, yeah. My queen.
It's one of my favorite movie performances. Like, she is so incredibly good from start to finish, from when she's first introduced, even kind of in the background when she's just a presence that is there, to all the way through some of her last lines of dialogue in the third act. Like, she is great, and she exudes this type of confidence that I just love when I see on screen. And it, so, like, all of these characters roll together. And I even liked Brendan Gleeson's lieutenant, or whatever he was, general.
I think he's back, Joey. I think he's back from far and away, if I had to guess.
Oh, I'll find out.
There is the sci-fi element of this that I love. I think it's really great. There's the Groundhog Day element that I love. There's also, like, the action is really good in this movie. Like, the action sequences are really well choreographed, so well shot too, which this could have been a mess, especially when you look at the design of those aliens. This just could have been a DC Comics mess of smoke and lightning and utter grossness, but it's not. Everything makes sense. You can see everything. It's beautiful cinematography. Everything about this, the editing in the macro, where we're just like, what are we seeing and when are we seeing it, you know, within the context of the movie, and then editing down to the micro, down to the frame. It's just all so good that when I get done watching it, every time when I get done watching it, I think this is probably the fourth time I've seen it, every time I get done and I'm just angry that the movie didn't do better.
I'm on such like an adrenaline rush even when it ends that like I'm almost want to put it right back on, because
yes.
Doug Liman does like such a great job of creating like urgency, and also like has a super sense of geography and everything, and like in a war movie it's like, my God. But like it's funny just to consider like they probably were like Cruise and Emily Blunt one day with the big map of the beach, and like, you know, trying to plan out all the shots and stuff with that and stuff. But it's just astounding like how much all this came together. And in a way, like, I almost feel like it shouldn't have worked this well. I mean, because these suits, I love them, but like, you know, like that same year I think we had Matt Damon wearing one in Elysium, right? And they're very Avatar-y kind of, like, you know. And so it's almost like Iron Man without totally being covered. So it was almost like it's a little redundant maybe, but no, it makes it its own and it owns it by the end. And I love that his name is Cage and he's like wearing a cage the whole movie and stuff. Like, it just, it makes sense to this story so much. And that supporting cast is like Emily Blunt with her Final Fantasy sword and everything. And like Bill Paxton and his little ragtag crew of alien rejects. Like, that works so well. You know, it's such a great little shorthand for what we need to get us embedded with this unit. You know, we don't have time. So like, we need to know that they have like these little quirks and personality things and stuff to tell them apart and everything. So
even if you go a little deeper, going back to your the thing about the mech suit, one thing that I really picked up on this time, which I didn't in previous viewings, maybe I'm just slow, I don't know, but like the idea that they're selling the mech suits as why they won the Battle of Verdun. What we find out is A, no, we won that battle because the aliens let us, and B, she lived that day how many times? So
yeah,
really,
exactly.
The suits are superfluous. Like, they don't actually mean anything. It was totally something else, which makes sense when you see them on the field in that opening battle sequence, that they're all just getting smashed. It doesn't matter.
It's also great that isn't Cruise, like, heading the firm that is, like, selling the suits or, like, putting the spin on it all working? Like, we see him very early on, you know, and he has that one conversation with Gleason when he's like, you know, my advertising firm got reassessed and I was assigned to the military, yada, yada. And he's like, I'm not a soldier or anything like that. So I thought it was a nice twist. Like, he actually ended up in the hardware he was hawking as like a miracle cure.
And I love that. Like, this film is peppered with all kinds of stuff like that. It's great. It really is phenomenal filmmaking from script to screen.
So a couple things that I want to touch on that you all made such great points about. Number one, Mike, yes, Brendan Gleeson is back from Far and Away. Also a recurring or returning person, Noah Taylor, who plays the scientist,
oh,
lab
yeah.
tech here.
The mustache.
He's back from Vanilla Sky. He also plays a lab tech in that one, too.
Oh, yeah.
Also great in this movie.
Yes, great in this movie. What I love, I think there's like this movie has like humor, like laced throughout. He's like, how many fingers do I have going behind my back? He's like, I don't know. This is the first time I've ever met you. Like, I just like that there's like things that, you know, it's, we just covered for Too Fast, Too Forever, My Cousin Vinny. It's like, how many fingers am I holding up? Like, please let the record show that he's holding up two fingers. It's like, there's like jokes there. Like, I just, wonderful. Love it. Whatever. But what I like about Emily Blunt, going back to Emily Blunt, because we can never talk enough about Emily Blunt. What I love about her performance here is that at certain times in this movie, she's essentially, to bring it back to a video game thing, she's playing an NPC. She's playing a non-playable character.
Right. It's like an escort
mission. No matter how he approaches her, she says the same things, right? Like, it just...
Mm-hmm. That's right, you know, yeah.
Why are you looking at me? Why are you, like, blah, blah, blah. And then, like, once you kind of get in there, it's, like, almost like the dialogue tree opens up in new ways. But when every time he sees her, as long as he's approaching, like, in a similar-ish way, she's still doing the same yoga pose. She's still doing the same icy reaction. She's still going to act this way and do whatever. And there's something really amazing about being able to act like a robot... but not, but like a person, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. My favorite shot of this movie is during the, and my favorite part, I think, is during the montage of her training him in the suit, right? And she just keeps shooting him over and over. And it's the part where it's like shot, and then the guy's like, maggot, you know, like over and
yes.
over. And
yes.
I'm pretty sure they're just using the same shot of Emily Blunt over and over again, but I'm not positive. And I think that's an attribute to what you're saying about her performance here is like, I don't know what's going on here, but it's like super powerful and like it's tricking me in a lot of ways where I'm like, I wonder if the filmmakers are screwing with me too, in a sense where it's like, no, like you think you know what you're looking at, but like we're switching it up on you to make her seem like a little more, I don't want to say like magical or anything like that, but just like, I don't know, not normal, or there's something more elevated about her or something. I'm not sure what I'm getting at exactly. I guess what I'm saying is I just love everything they're doing with her character, and I love that shot, and I need to talk about it real quick. So
I do want to give credit to someone who's never going to listen to this, I don't think. But do you remember, Mike, on our, oh boy, what was that movie, The Bad Keanu Replicas?
Oh, yeah. Wait, with Tommy Middledy?
With Tommy Middledy, yes. On that episode, we had somebody from the Loose Cannons podcast that rebranded as something else, and I found them because I found their year-end video montage, editing montage, right? He did his top 100 movies of the decade so far, like in 2018 or something like that, and this was on there, and the way that he edited maybe Hypnotize by Notorious B.I.G., like he syncs a Biggie song to this clip, and it's the her bending up over and over again, and like, so like it's very clearly the same shot, but like the way that he's able to edit like the same shot with the same like repeating beat, it's just, it's beautiful. What you were saying, Mike, like whether in this movie they use the same shot or slight variation or whatever, like there's something hypnotic about the way that Emily Blunt can do the same thing over and over again, and you like, you still can't take your eye, like it's just like, I know what she's doing, like I just, it's, I can't look away.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much like presence in this film. Like I almost wondered, because I have not read the manga source material, but I thought I heard something about it being more about the Full Metal Bitch character. I'm not sure if that's true, but like, I definitely think that she could have carried this movie on her own, you know, with like her being the Cruz character, or seeing her at the Battle of Verdun or whatever was going on before this movie or something. Like, I know there's talks of a sequel, that they've been talking about a sequel for a really long time. I don't know how
it's happening
or
it's
what.
Pre-production.
Okay, I mean, I don't know where they're gonna go with this story or anything, but I hope it's more sort of centered and focused around her character next time, just because like that's the one thing I think I wanted more of. I think she kind of got like, even though she comes back, she kind of gets like an unceremonious last death during the finale and stuff, and so it's just kind of like I wanted more.
So in the comic, for this is all according to the IMDb trivia, she never loses the ability. She just senses that she basically senses that someone else is able to reset the day. And so spoilers for the comic, I guess, but in the end she has Cruz's character Cage kill her so that he can, like, I guess, single-handedly win or whatever. Some version of that or whatever, right? And so I wonder...
There can only be one.
Maybe, if it's a Highlander situation, don't...
Oh, God,
I guess,
no.
Trigger word for Nick, having watched all five or whatever
oh, sorry.
In the last year or two. 5% of Real Bad is about Highlander. Who boy.
Pretty
sorry,
much,
Nicole,
yeah.
Again, in retrospect. Yeah, like, I wonder if in the sequel, because he obviously has it now, right? Because he dies, but he gets covered in the goo again, and it resets. So he... ostensibly has it. Maybe she still does too. Maybe there's another alien invasion. Like, who? Because they are also talking about early in the movie, I think, right? Like, there's like other satellites or whatever that like, could have other aliens. And it's the kind of movie where, like, I don't know that we want a sequel, but like, if it's good, it's good. And if it's not good, we can just pretend it doesn't exist. Like, I don't think about Pacific Rim Uprising. I can just, you know, enjoy Pacific Rim.
Or the filmmakers can pretend it didn't exist, just like Highlander 2.
Yeah, you could just slap on like the generic director name when no one wants to put their name on the movie. There's like this name that's used, and I think like maybe
Alan
12
Smithy.
Films. Yeah, that was it.
Nick, do you have a favorite moment or a favorite part part of this movie? I mentioned mine. I think Mike mentioned his. Is there something about this that stands out above all the rest of your favorite part of Edge of Tomorrow?
There is a really well-crafted moment. The montage where he's getting better and better and better at training with her that I think ends with him walking in the rain and fighting the two guys. I think that's the buildup to it. But there is, we've seen these montages of people getting better and better and better in all kinds of movies, action movies, science fiction movies, whatever they may be. There is something special about how his characterization changes through that montage. Even though there's a lot about Tom Cruise, the person, I don't like, I have to admit that he is a really, really good actor. And yeah. And when he's paired with a good director, that sequence of him becoming better and better, how his body language changes, how his facial expressions change, how his movement changes, like, I love it. It's pure cinema, and I just love it. And every time I get to it, I get very excited. And I'm just like, ooh, I wonder if I'm going to learn something new from watching this. It's like, it's really, so that is my favorite thing. I have a lot of favorite moments in this film, but that's the one that, especially on the last watch, really affected me.
Yeah. It's so great too, because, you know, like, I always found the training montage, while I love it, is there's always something just so, like, it just reminds you so hard that you're watching a movie no matter what. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But what's great about this movie is that the whole idea of him repeating a day works with the idea of a training montage, I feel like, in general.
The whole movie is a training montage.
Pretty much. So, like, it just sort of elevates that to make it one of the best, like, in film history, montages in general.
It is. But it also, you know, it pairs well with the idea that, you know, he's dying every time, and there is pain, and there is, it's not just a simple thing of, like, you know, Phil wakes up in the morning from maybe going to sleep or whatever. Like, his reset button is painful and scary and horrifying for him. And so that carries over into this montage. Maybe not on the first viewing, but if you watch it a couple of times, you do start to pick up on, like, it goes back to what you guys were saying earlier about, like, he is now, like, at the end of this movie, it's been a day, but he is now a war vet. And that makes him different. He's seen things and he has experienced things. And that montage is not only just showing him becoming awesome, but also it's showing a part of his humanity going away because of what he's having to witness. And so, yeah, that montage is really quite brilliant for me.
I also love, I think, like, a moment that hits me hard like that too later on is when he realizes he has to try it without Emily Blunt. Like, he's woken up by the drill sergeant, and the drill sergeant's like, get up on your feet, maggot. And he takes, like, one look at Cruise and kind of has, like, a, oh shit, like, what's this guy been through kind of look. Like, he's got that stare in his eye already, you know. And then that whole sequence of him in sort of like that kind of half motion, just dominating the beach on his own and doing it. But, like, yeah, there's so many moments that just, like, they hit all those, like, important beats to make you feel the growth of the character, which is great.
Absolutely.
Now, on the flip side of the coin, is there something about this movie that you don't like that we would fix? Your least favorite part of Edge of Tomorrow, Nick? Anything that you want to point out that you don't love about this movie?
You know, kind of hard to say, because I do think it is a, I do think from beginning to end, it's pretty solid. I am never a fan of crappy green screen news report things, and that opening sequence of the news reports about what was happening, maybe the movie doesn't work as well without it. I'm not sure, but it really initially set me off on the wrong foot. Just, I don't know, it just seemed like everything seemed so fake. I think Anderson Cooper's voice was used at the beginning, which is also something that I'm like, I don't like it when movies do that. Like, I don't know, there's something about that that is not great for me. And I still, and even in this film, when it starts, I'm like, oh crap, I forgot about this. So yeah, that opening montage of news reports and crews being interviewed, and there was something about it that didn't work for me.
It's the second movie in a row, Mike, that we've had with this and Oblivion, where we get, like, a hit over the head with a lot of information just quickly, but I think the way that this movie does it is a lot more graceful than Oblivion, even though it's, like, crazy in your face. I think it works a lot better here than it does in Oblivion. And I also do want to say that, like, at one point, there's Brendan Gleeson on screen, like a split screen with Wolf Blitzer, and Wolf Blitzer is going to return in Mission Impossible Fallout in a much bigger role. So no spoilers for that. Nick hasn't seen any Mission Impossible movies since 2, so
I won't spoil that, but
Wolf Blitzer comes back in Fallout 2 in a weird cool role.
I definitely hear what Nick's saying. I generally don't like when opening credits are used as a exposition dump for any movie, to be quite honest with you. But, you know, if it has to be done, I guess it has to be done. There seems to, I mean, this just feels like a moment where there is an extra 15 or 10 minutes before the action that they just have decided to chop or, you know, and just condense. For what it is, it's funny. Like, I remember it kind of rubbing me the wrong way initially, but, like, now it just feels kind of realistic. Like, if there was, like, an alien invasion, there would just be, like, this pop-coated news every day that would just be like, yeah, everything's fine, everything's cool, like, we got these new suits, it's gonna work out, yada yada, like, here's the plan. And so there's something this time around that was just like, oh, look at this confidence that they have, and they're just gonna get crushed immediately.
I don't know if it's a difference of show not tell, but like the visuals of this as opposed to just Tom Cruise being like, the year is 2077, 60 years ago, we had a football game, and then this.
Oh, happened, yeah,
this
yeah, happened. Yeah, it's like, Dear Diary of time, right? Like, I'd prefer this from Dear Diary any day.
I do want to say that this movie apparently takes place in 2020, so this is this year. So I guess we're maybe building toward this. This would, you know, an alien invasion would really make this year, like, really crowning gem of, like, what this year is missing, right? Just, like, alien invasion to, like, totally mess us up.
Really tie the room together.
Yeah, it really would.
Mike, what about you? Anything about this movie that you don't love? Least favorite moment?
I don't think this is necessarily like a slight against the movie. I think this is more a thing, like, Nick, it's just like modern filmmaking, maybe, like a byproduct of that. I can't see as much as I'd like during the final assault on the Louvre. Like, when they hit Paris with the motley crew and their whatever dragon ass across, or like hydroplaning their jet, and like, I want to see more of really what's going on. And I get it, the cover of night and stuff, but I feel like shoot a little day for night or whatever. And you know, movies in the past have done a better job of showing darkness clearer than that. And so I was just kind of like, ooh, I don't know if this was like a time restraint kind of thing, or maybe like a, like they switched up the third act some kind of way and they just needed to rush it a bit. But it was definitely the only time in the movie where I was like, ooh, these effects are starting to like really get to me. And I was just glad that like it was at the end and didn't really have to like put up with too much more of it. And, you know, again, it's not going to kill the movie. You know, I'm going to definitely watch it 100 more times if I can. But like, if I had to, you know, nitpick, I had to search really hard for that.
I did think of a Tom Nexion, not a Cruise Nexion, but a Tom Nexion inter Tom play there at the end. You know, they're like, this thing's not going to fly. It's like, we don't need to fly. We just need to get with a lot of speed over there really quick. And I was thinking at the end of the first Toy Story where Buzz Lightyear's like, we're not flying, we're falling with style. It's just like, neither of us are flying. It's just like, we're getting from here to there in a different way. And I was like, you know, a little Tom Nexion. My least favorite part is at the end. I think I could be talked into liking it. And especially after I found out the backstory behind it. But at the very end of the movie, actually, let me take a step back. So Emily Blunt is gorgeous. Tom Cruise is gorgeous. There's sexual chemistry between the two of them. Yet he keeps living the same day over again, and she meets him every day, right? So, like, there's sexual tension, there's sexual chemistry, but, like, there's never really a relationship. And there's sweet moments, like, when they go to the barn, and, you know, he knows how she likes her coffee, and that's only in that moment she's like, wait, we've been here before. Like, how many times have we been here before? And I like the jokes of, like, you know, have you tried everything about getting it back? Like, have you tried having sex a lot? Like, I could have sex a lot. Like, that's really funny. But at the end, when they're about to go, and they're about to go, you know, she's going to be the decoy, and he's going to go kill the Omega, and then she kisses him. I'm like, she's known him for like 18 hours. Yeah. And I get that it's a very tense, emotionally draining, emotionally invested time, but like, it feels very movie to me. Mm-hmm. What really blew my mind was that was Emily Blunt improvising.
Oh,
that well. Moment is not in the script. That moment was a surprise to Doug Liman. That moment was a surprise to Tom Cruise. She said it just felt right and I did it. It's cool that it's her agency, but it feels to me very movie moment. Like the two action yeah. heroes kiss before the big action finale. Yeah. And I don't love that.
It's weird because to me it seems out of character for her, for Rita. Because she is such a pragmatic, like, we have to do this, we have to do this, we have to do this, this is the plan. Oh, now things are even more heightened, oh God. So I would agree with you. I think I blinked every time that happened because I have no memory of it.
Yeah, this was the first time I actually caught that. I must have seen this movie, no joke, like 5 times now all the way through, right? And I, you know, what I thought was like, huh, that's interesting. And then the immediate thought that came into my mind was, for luck. Almost like when Princess Leia kissed her brother without knowing it. Like, you know, and they're at the very
end. Wait,
they're
brother and sister?
Oh, spoilies.
Oh, spoilers.
Spoilies. But yeah, like, that's what came into my mind. I was like, we're here. We're at the very last boss. Here's an extra power-up or whatever. Here's a boost. Like, it's just for luck. Go get him, sucker. You know, because I didn't feel any sexual vibe between either of them the whole movie.
It has such a different weight for the two of them. Like, Cruise has spent 1,000 days with her, right? Like,
they've had 50 first dates, yes. We'll put it in Adam Sandler terms.
Like, yeah, he has time to fall. He's had time to fall in love with her, right? It's right. Just, she doesn't. She hasn't. The weight of it, like, it feels like in that moment he should kiss her, but I also understand why that would be weird. So, like, the fact that she kisses him, I guess, is better. But, like, the way that it's shot, like, they're like, okay, I'm, like, she's like, we're, neither of us are, it's the conversation where she's like, neither of us are getting out of here, we know what we have to do, I'm gonna go be a distraction, because I think it's, like, one of those, like, you can't let yourself be killed, I'll let myself be killed, you go kill the Omega, whatever, and she's like, look, we're, neither of us are getting out of here, I'm gonna go do this, you go do that, we're both gonna die, but we're gonna save the world. Their faces are, like, 6 inches apart for, like, what feels like forever. It's probably, like, 8 or 10 seconds. Like, it's not that long. But, like, I just want her to go away. She kisses him. I'm just like, it's like, it's not terrible, but I'm just like, it feels, what you said, Nick, it feels out of character for her.
Well, and, you know, I guess here's the thing that I don't say very often. There's a lot of stuff that, well, actually, I say this all the time, especially I used to say a lot to students, but there are things that happen in real life. There are situations that happen. There are feelings. There are impulses that you can have that make sense in the moment. Like, they feel right in the moment, but that for some reason put to film don't make any sense. The context isn't there for some reason. It just doesn't quite line up. It doesn't quite work. And this may be one of those things that, yeah, in a heightened situation like that, maybe she's just realizing she knows this guy has been through this 1,000 times and she's impressed with him and she is, you know, and she knows that she's about to die. She wants one last thing. That wasn't communicated very clearly for right. that moment. That being said, since I still have no memory of it, I don't know if I don't know if I just legitimately happened to look down. This happened to me on Avengers Endgame, where in the theater I was like, yeah, Captain Marvel never really got to have a moment. And then I watched it again on Disney Plus and I was like, oh, wait, no, she totally had a moment. How did I miss
this?
Yeah,
no, she saves the Earth.
Yeah. I don't know. It's very possible that I just happened to look away or happened to respond to a text or something at that exact moment. And I just happened to miss it all 4 or 5 times I've watched this movie.
Can something at least be said to the fact that it's maybe the greatest throwaway kiss in a film that, like, 2 out of 3 people don't even remember it?
Maybe I made it up. No, I didn't make it up. And the thing I was trying to remember, I cut it out of the podcast because I was stumbling over my words, but I was trying to remember something I experience. I thought it was something I watched, but it was something I read, where the book Recursion by Blake Crouch, which I read at the end of last year, I mentioned on some other podcast. I don't remember what we were talking about, Mike, but it's, again, it's kind of a time loop movie or time loop story. And in that, like, there's a couple and they keep, like, resetting and, like, everything like that. And it's like this, like, but they're both kind of able to do it and they're experiencing, like, 40 years and then they reset. And, like, it's just like this whole, like, you're living an Whoa. Entire life. Like, it's not just a day. It's like you live a life with a person and right. then you have to reintroduce yourself to that person. And, like, that just feels exhausting. Like, all of this
right?
feels exhausting.
Yeah, and that's
this
like...
just feels the, like, the most draining thing in the world. Like, in an amazing way cinematically, but, like, can you imagine having to, like, live through those first, like, 8 hours, like, just getting to her every day.
Yeah.
And having to, like, even though she knows she's been in that situation, having to explain to her, like, no, I have what you had. It's like, I wish, like, we could just, like, press a button, like, just, okay, we're good. Like, I'm here. Like, fast forward.
The movie does such a clever editing job of skipping over that night almost every single time, even to the degree where, like, he is shown in the dropship with duct tape around his mouth, and it's like, has he had that on for, like, 12 hours? Like, I don't care. This movie rules. But, Joey, to your point of, like, exhaustion, that's almost the reason why I, like, saved the movie Primer for select viewing, because that movie exhausts me just thinking about how many times and how far back and how much does this guy have. He must have, like, books and books of what he needs to do every time he goes back and stuff. And it reminded me of this watching it, where it's like, that isn't resetting the day per se, like, this is, but, like, it kind of is the same idea done in a different way, and, you know, just as intriguing for sure. But
speaking of Primer, I pulled up when we were talking before about, like, how many Groundhog Day stories there had been. There is a Wikipedia article called List of Films Featuring Time Loops. So Groundhog Day, believe it or not, was actually the 6th movie, according to this, that actually had one. The first one was The Girl Who Leapt Through Time in 1983. Mm-hmm. There was one in 84, 87, 90, another thing in 93, and then Groundhog Day also in 93. So it's like 5th or 6th. But then there were, like, you know, 4 more in the 90s. Then
really?
There were, like... Yeah, in the 90s, I mean, it's not necessarily Groundhog Day, but it's the idea of going back through time and, like, looping in some way or another.
Okay.
But there's, like, Christmas Every Day, Retroactive, Run Lola Run, Mickey's Once Upon a Christmas. And then in the 2000s, there's a bunch. And then, like since 2016, basically, there have been 15 of them. Like, Ark and Doctor Strange and Hurok and Miss Peregrine and Before I Fall and A Day and The Endless and Happy Death Day and Naked and Reset and The Fair and Happy Death Day to You. And I know it's not exactly this, but it's still the same idea of reliving time or, like, looping through time or being unstuck in time. It's not exactly Groundhog Day the way that this is, kind of, with a genre twist, or Happy Death Day is, but there's the idea of, like, the looping that does play a lot. And
yeah,
you know, Doctor Strange, like, it's beautiful in Doctor Strange too, like in that final battle, right? But, like,
yeah, but I would like to somehow differentiate the idea of character wakes up reliving the same day with general time travel movie, because this is just, you know, this is just like a paradox that happens in time travel films, where, like, someone, or most, or a lot of them, right, is the idea, like, what about Back to the Future 2 or Avengers Endgame? Can't those, you know, they're reliving the same day in a lot of ways, spoilies, but I'm saying, like, there needs to be more criteria, I think, to make it on the list. But that's just me. I still love all these movies.
There's a thing on runp.com, which I think is the website that tells you when to go to the bathroom in a
movie. Yeah.
They rank, there's 20 of them in order. Groundhog Day was the second one. Before that was the movie called Cause and Effect. But since then, movies that I know about, Run Lola Run, there was an episode of The X-Files called Monday, Source Code, Edge of Tomorrow, Before I Fall, Happy Death Day.
Yeah, Source Code, that's solid conceit, yeah.
Doctor Strange, like, there's a bunch of them, right? Like, there's a bunch of different ones where it's not like they're doing two or three a year, but there's a lot of examples out there. The bottom line, the TLDR, is if you don't do it really well, people are gonna be like, oh, I've seen that before. Like, Simpsons did it, but, like, Groundhog Day did it.
Yeah, or they won't remember it. I don't know. I think it's got to be sort of the whole movie as opposed to just, like, the climax or a part or whatever. But there was actually another one I wanted to mention. I don't know if you guys ever heard of this. It's actually, the last new found footage movie I watched, because I just don't really like him. But there was something called, like, The Almanac or something like that. And it was kind of cool where, like, this guy found his dad's time machine and him and his friends went around, like, skipping school and going to, like, Coachella and things.
Project Almanac.
Project Almanac. Yeah. Actually did it pretty well for the found footage genre.
I think I saw that in theaters.
Oh,
is that
okay.
Possible? Any other notes, Nick? Any other thoughts about Edge of Tomorrow before we do some trivia? I have a couple of last-minute things, but any other thoughts that you have and want to share about Edge of Tomorrow?
I just want more people to watch this movie.
Yeah.
I want more people to talk about this movie.
Yeah.
In a time when a lot, like, everybody complains, especially, and when this was coming out, people were complaining about this as well. When people are complaining about, you know, everything's a comic book movie and everything is this and everything is that. I mean, yeah, this is based on a manga? This feels like an original movie. Like, this isn't taking something you're already aware of. This is an original science fiction movie. It's great. It is exactly the kind of movie that I love to see. And, you know, I don't really care if things are based on other things. Like, that isn't a complaint that I have. But it is, like, it's not Iron Man. It's not Batman. It's not, you know, it's not any of these other comic book things. It's just this self-contained story. And, oh my God, I love it so much.
Yeah, very well said. Mike, any other thoughts? Any other notes?
I mean, I agree with everything Nick said. I pretty much agree with everything both you guys said the entire evening. I think I love this movie because of, like, how unique it is. Like, you know, not in the sense that, look, there are, like we've been talking about, there are these time loop movies out there, but there's not another, like, alien invasion movie quite like this. There's not another Tom Cruise movie quite like this. You know, there's not, like, visually, aesthetically, like, all the things going on here, like, just push every one of my buttons. And I love it for that. I love that it exists. I love that it, like, caught me off guard, that I wasn't really, you know, that I sort of, like, went into it the first time, like, not really expecting much from it, and then just being, like, incredibly blown away, like, straight to the moon. And you just got to give it up once again for Emily Blunt. Like, I think this is the movie that I was brought to attention with her. Like, I known she was in Devil Wear Prada, but I never imagined her to pull, like, a Furiosa. She is incredible in this movie, and, you know, now in, like, The Quiet Place and all kinds of stuff, like, her career character's
Sicario?
Great. Yeah, Sicario, another, like, maybe that's another perfect movie right there with her in it. I mean, even Mary Poppins, I thought she was great last year. So I'm, like, 100% on board with her ever since then as well. So just great all around.
So Tom Cruise is from Cranberry, New Jersey, which is, like, half an hour from me. So that's very exciting as a local boy, where they make tomatoes, not cranberries. And then two Mission Impossible connections that I have here. He flies a helicopter in this movie, which he does in a bunch of Mission Impossible movies. And also at the end, he swims down to take out the Omega, which is very Rogue Nation of him, which we'll get to very soon.
Did he fly the helicopter as Tom Cruise?
So here's two things that I know. He did all of his stunts for this movie. And then at the premiere, they actually did three premieres in one day. They did one in London, one in Paris, and then they flew to New York, and they did one in New York, and it was at midnight.
That's pretty funny. That's
in the morning, and he landed a helicopter at one of them.
Oh, okay.
He can. Whether he did in this movie or not, I don't know, but I know he did all of his own stunts.
Well, if he did all of his own stunts, there is a shot of him flying the helicopter. It would not surprise me if he was flying the helicopter.
I saw one cool behind-the-scenes shot of how they were all rigged up in those mech suits and stuff, that there was like this giant crane with a pulley system kind of like assisting them as they ran in those suits, because they were actually like wearing very heavy, you know, material.
Oh, I have trivia about that too. Yeah, absolutely.
So like behind the scenes, the some that I've watched was like cool enough to be like, I want to watch like a whole documentary about this movie now.
So in terms of stunts, the thing, the plank that Emily Blunt is doing where she's on her hands and no other part of her body is touching the ground, like, she's aided by wires there, but apparently she can do that in real life, like, without touching the ground. She can just hold her body up with her hands or whatever, which is
right. The wires would just make her still.
Yeah. So, okay, so here's some trivia. There's a bunch here. I apologize, but I culled it down from a lot to the interesting bits. So when the guy, Hiroshi Sakurazaka, wrote the novel, he got the idea from video gaming, resetting a game over and over again until finding the winning strategy. So basically, he's like, I'm going to write a manga about speedrunning, so Mike, you've been right all night.
Huh.
So the reason that she uses like a broadsword is because it makes sense. Like they talk about this in the comic book. Guns can jam. You can run out of bullets, but like a big ass sharp sword is never going to not work.
Is it a helicopter blade? I think it's a helicopter blade in the movie.
It might be,
but yeah.
Well, and it looks like a direct reference to Final Fantasy VII.
It does, which the remake is now out. And I've never played either of them. I know. When doing a car chase, Emily Blunt was instructed to drive fast and then take a right-hand turn so the van would shake, except she screwed up and she drove into a tree and she freaked out because Tom Cruise was in the car and she could have killed both of them. And apparently they just started laughing about it. So, like, it was a very nerve-wracking thing that you know, he's just like, hey, I do my own stunts, including stunts that I didn't know were going to be stunts, like when my co-star drives me into a tree. So the suit, Mike, you mentioned, weighed 85 pounds. Or 85 to 90, and the armaments were between 120 and 125 pounds.
That's too many pounds.
It's a lot of pounds. And Tom Cruise didn't want them to be too CGI. He wanted them to look real. So he apparently showed up 2 months early to help develop the suit.
Whoa.
Emily Blunt, when she put it on, she started crying, according to IMDb trivia, because it was so heavy. She was jokingly told by Tom Cruise to, quote, stop being such a wuss, which I guess is just like, yeah, like, she probably weighs, what, like, 110, 120, 130 pounds, like, to be almost double your body weight, like, that's insane. That's crazy.
Yeah, she's got to be a buck 10.
The guy who yells at her, bloody hell, it's a Full Metal bitch, and she punches in the beginning of the movie, is her brother in real life.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's perfect.
One thing that we have not heard in a while, but I think we heard a while back, was that Tom Cruise apparently saw her in other movies and, like, wanted to work with her, and so he basically, I don't know if he cast her or just like was like, hey, let's do this, but he basically got her hired, which, you know, when you're Tom Cruise, you can choose who you work with.
I wonder what performance that was to be like, she could do this. Not that she can't do anything or whatever, but I mean she kind of plays like, if you had to, in Devil Wears Prada, she's not like the nicest person, but like, I don't know that that's like, I'm sure she's done tons of work that just was not released in America and he's just got access to everything.
So before this, years before this, like in 2010, I saw Sunshine Cleaning, which was really good.
Okay.
Where she, I don't remember who is in the movie with her, but she and her sister open
Amy
up
Amy Adams,
like a,
maybe?
Maybe. They open up like a, when a person dies, like they'll go in and clean up like the blood or the whatever in the house.
The crime scenes and stuff.
One of the one of the funniest things is that apparently in reshoots, they added Jeremy Piven to the movie.
What?
Because they're like, we need to add Jeremy Piven. And then everything that they shot, he got cut out. So they thought, in retrospect, We need to add Jeremy Piven to this movie. And then they're like, on second thought, never
Wait,
mind.
Well, first of all, I can't imagine that thought ever popping into someone's head. Two, is that are those the deleted scenes? And three, I could have used a little Stanley Tucci in here somewhere, maybe, but that's the only extra addition I would have peppered in.
Man, yeah, I agree.
Jeez, does he sing Jeremy Piven? Two other things. I saved the sort of the biggest ones for last. So originally considered, and this is actually a two-parter, originally considered for the role of Bill Cage was something we did a podcast about.
Nick Cage.
For Ryan Gosling.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if Gosling would work. I think he's too restrained.
He's too quiet, maybe?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like, I love him. Obviously, I love him. But, like, I don't know that he works here.
I think what works so well for me, for Cruise here, is that I was not expecting him to be a sniveling coward in the opening of this, right? But, like, I could kind of see Gos doing that and making it work. I mean, that's sort of him in The Nice Guys. He's, like, this, you know, false bravado dude and stuff. But here I think it works better.
Has Gosling done an action movie that isn't a Refn movie?
Blade Runner.
Yeah.
He gets down in that. Yeah, but, like, that's, again, that's kind of, it's almost Refn-y. Like, it's the contemplative.
Yeah, he's never done something like, you know, like what The Rock does, right? Like The Rundown or anything, like a Fast and Furious. But
also considered for the role, which I could see and I would also love, Mr. Brad Pitt.
Okay, now that I could see. Didn't World War Z kind of come out around this time, which is like...
It was a year before, I think.
Because I think that might have been his, like, I'm going to do sort of a mainstream blockbuster, I'm ready, right? Like, he had never quite gotten there yet, and maybe he was just a year too soon to do this movie.
What I just saw before we started recording, which is crazy, which is not anything to do with Cruise Club, but has to do with Cage Club, is that when there's a whole thing on The Hollywood Reporter about Matthew Vaughn trying to get Kick-Ass made. He had met Brad Pitt while they were filming Snatch, and the original casting for Big Daddy was going to be Brad Pitt, which would have been crazy. But then Tarantino swooped in and was like, hey, come do Bastards. So he did Bastards, and then they cast Cage as Big Daddy, which
worked out
for everybody. But like,
yeah, I think that was good for everyone involved.
But I can also see Brad Pitt as Big Daddy. I think that would have been good too. But, you know, Cage as Big Daddy is chef's kiss.
Exactly. I think Cage brought that whole Adam West vibe to it, which just accelerated that entire performance.
Yeah, clearly Brad Pitt would just bring the Clooney Batman, just, you know, the Danny Ocean Batman. And the final bit of trivia that I have, then we have to play a couple games, is this is the alternate ending that almost was. So as they approach Paris in the dropship, Cage tells the soldiers that they must not kill an alpha or it will cause a time loop, and we'll be right back here having this conversation. We won't even know it. During fighting, one of the soldiers gets separated, then confronts and kills an alpha. The audience sees the Omega reset the day and witnesses the same conversation as before about not killing an alpha, but then an attack starts, and the audience knows that the mimics have the upper hand as the movie ends. Which is a fucking downer of an ending.
Yeah, no, we can't do that this late in the game. You can't, no. I think if anything were to happen, like, Emily Blunt gets the power back instead of Tom Cruise at the end of the movie, you know? Like, that's the switch up, I think, if anything.
I think this whole movie was designed to leave you feeling good.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's a lot in here that you feel, you do feel bad about. Like, you do feel bad about the death, the pain that these people have to go through, the pain that Rita has obviously had to go through, both emotional and physical. But obviously this is a action romp and it does it so well. I think the idea of going with a downbeat ending doesn't really make sense for this movie. At least it wouldn't to me. I don't think I'd be as disappointed as I'd be like, wait, what? That, what, huh?
Yeah, it'd almost be like Phil Connors, like, at the very end of that day waking up again, right? Or, like, realizing it didn't, you know? Like, it's against the idea of the whole conceit in the first place for me, which is, like, you eventually break the loop and, like, you succeed and, you know.
Yeah, and that one, it was learn to be a decent human being. That's an odd thing that they wanted to go that way.
Yeah, I'm glad
apparently
they did.
I think they shot it, too. I cut this part out because it wasn't as interesting, but, like, some of the reactions to, like, how he's talking to them, like, feel like it's from that ending. I don't know, but I don't know. Okay, very important question. We just talked about how Mr. Brad Pitt, Mr. Ryan Gosling were almost or maybe possibly Cage in this movie. Do you think, and I think the answer is very clearly no, even though he's been in war movies before, could Tom Hanks play the role of Major/Private Bill Cage?
No.
Or, if not, who could he be? I think, yeah, no is the answer, but, like, if not, who could he play in this movie?
Oh, he could have played Bill Paxton's part, even though I love Bill Paxton.
I'd have loved to have seen Hanks do a drill sergeant. That'd have been cool. I was going to say the scientist, you know, as like a cameo.
I think he could also play maybe the Brenda Gleason role.
Yeah.
Yeah, could be. Oh, that was something we didn't really talk about here. I did like the fact that it felt, it didn't feel just like the American army. It felt like it was a congregation of a few different armies.
Oh, well, yeah. One of my favorite sort of flourishes is when he wakes up the first time, there's all the announcements in all different languages going over the PA speaker. I was like, man, that's such a nice little subtle touch.
So now, first question here. Or I guess second question, since we all said no to the Hanks thing.
Sorry, Hanks.
Does Tom Cruise run in this movie? And I think the answer is yes. I mean, as much as he can in a 100-pound suit, but yes.
I mean, even without it, there's some stuff he does near the end, I believe, where he's running.
My favorite run, though, is like sort of, I guess it's, you know, at the height of him and Emily Blunt's sort of tag team, and he saves his his platoon, the J squad or whatever, like he just comes running around the little hill and they're like, what the hell.
I agree. That was great.
Now a different question. You might remember this from the Lestat conversation. We found someone on Twitter, Harperfect, who said you could replace Tom Cruise's character name in any movie with the name Lightning McQueen and not a thing would change. Do you think if he was Major or Private Lightning McQueen, this movie would still work?
No.
Why not?
I don't think it works. I think the name Cage works really well because he is very, I mean, it's a metaphorical name. He's caged. He's trapped. He is terrified of everything. And I think that works. I think if you give him over the top cool guy name, it starts to kind of mess with the overall arc of the character. It's like, is he already cool? If he's already cool and everything, then why does he have to go through this journey? Not that you'd be having those thoughts on the surface, but I don't think it works in here. I think the name Bill Cage works for him.
There's something so bland at first sight about the name William Cage or Bill Cage, or, you know, it's just like such an innocuous name where it's just like, here's a guy who just like gets lost in the system or whatever. And yet there's so much meaning behind it in this movie that like to lose it would sort of ruin his character, maybe. Having said that, I definitely think his first name could be Lightning. No, I'm just kidding.
Lightning Cage. Well, what's also kind of a nice bit of fortuitous naming is that the name Cage comes from the Japanese character, the name in the manga, Keiji, K-E-I-J-I. And I don't know if that sounds like it or if they translate or whatever, but like, it works as both the translation and also just as the he's a man in a cage.
And then he's in a literal cage later on, like you guys were saying, and I love it. I just love that.
All right, so I guess we'll say no to Lightning McQueen, unfortunately. The final thing we have to do is nominate this for some awards. Actually, Nick, do you have any thoughts on what we can name these awards? We are running out of daylight here in terms of naming the awards. The golden something, the silver something, whatever we want, sort of like, I don't know, like we've done the golden peaches, the golden hot dogs, the...
We have the golden woodies going
on. Black and chrome teeth.
Oh, yeah, we
did. Why do we do teeth?
Oh, because Charlize has dentures, I think. I don't remember. I don't know.
That was, I think that was for Fury Road.
Fury Road? Yeah, the chrome was definitely Fury Road, so maybe the teeth.
Why was it teeth? Well, there's teeth. She dated the dentist in That Thing You Do.
I don't know what we were thinking half the time.
I don't know, but we need a name for the awards, for the Cruise Club Awards.
The Cruise Club Awards could be, oh, geez, I am bad at this stuff, but let me think here. What do we got?
Hanks, we have the obvious, it's the Woodies. It's just the Sheriff Woody Awards, right? So, like, easy slam dunk here.
We've been throwing around the sunglasses.
It's got to be something maybe from Mission Impossible, but, like, the case files doesn't sound right. Like
the self-destructies, the need for speedies, the Mavericks.
Ooh, that's
Mavericks
not...
isn't bad. I actually just thought in the need for speedies, we could do with the golden hammers and just drop the hammer on somebody.
Okay.
That's a very kind of like, people know Days of Thunder, but people don't
the
know
mellow
Days of
yellows.
Thunder that way.
Yeah.
We'll keep thinking, but best film or best of the worst, for sure, best film.
I mean, may just win it.
We'll find out. Best Cruise role, yes?
It's up there. I still hold Lestat, I think, as a better overall performance. No, I don't. I take that back.
Ooh.
I think this is actually a sneaky good performance.
What I like about both roles, to compare the two that you just mentioned, they're both living far more life than a normal person.
Yeah.
He's a secret vampire.
Yeah.
Life extension.
Tell me why so. I definitely would say this is in the running for me. The work that he does in this is really way better than I think people talk about. I think specifically that montage, and then the scene that Mike, I think you were bringing up when he was talking, when he decides to do it without Rita. And just this hollowed out shell he's become. He's not doing much, but yet he's doing a lot. And it's really, so yeah, I may consider this.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's Mike, a I'm really assuming, good role.
Mike, I'm assuming you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that, I mean, not just for a Cruise movie, but like we see a complete shifting character with this character. Like we see a complete change in this guy from beginning to end, like basically from a guy who wants credit for doing nothing to someone who doesn't take credit for saving the world, kind of is like how I thought about it. And, you know, that's awesome. It's kind of rare. And I was like, yeah, I definitely got to nominate him this time around.
Most badass role, I'm going to throw that there too, because it is.
Oh, yeah.
It's very badass.
Most daring role to take, I do not think so. Most wasted performance, I do not think so. Best fight is a very good question. Because I think it's kind of in the spirit of best fights, but they're also kind of CGI bullet fights, right? Or do we want to say blindly dodging fists in the rain?
I call everything that's good in this movie a battle.
Okay,
right,
so
yeah.
We can skip that maybe. Yeah, okay.
One thing I was expecting, actually, and I actually thought it was in the movie and it's not, is I thought he and Emily Blunt during the training actually like sort of battle it out against each other in the training zone, but he just uses those like twirly droids and things like that. So if there was like a, you know, a throwdown between the two of them during the training, then maybe.
A bro-down throwdown? Best theme song, soundtrack, score? No.
Unmemorable, generally.
Best vehicle chase, race? No. I mean, he's kind of in a vehicle, but not really, the mech suit.
Wait a minute. We got to talk about the minivan.
Okay.
Now, is it best? I don't know, but it is there.
I'll say minivan getaway.
Yeah, that minivan getaway with the trailer and and it getting shredded and then eventually just falling off was really entertaining.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. That's a good point. I'm glad you remember that. Glad you called that out. You don't remember the kiss, but you remember the minivan.
I don't remember the
kiss. Very interesting. Best dance scene. I think, like we talked about earlier, a lot of the movie could be seen as dancing, but I don't know that it is. There's no actual dancing in this, right?
No.
Nope.
Best Cruise outfit wardrobe?
I mean, that suit, the cage suit.
Okay.
I mean, that's pretty awesome.
Especially when he is not wearing the helmet. It looks pretty badass.
Where's your helmet? Never wear one. It's a distraction.
Yeah. That's great.
I also love that line where he's like, hey, there's something wrong with your suit. And he's like, yeah, there's a dead guy in it.
And they all get real quiet, like, oh, whoa, that went somewhere.
Best sunglasses? No, right?
Yeah,
I don't think he ever does he wear them?
No, I don't think he gets a chance.
The most difficult category, I don't know what to do here. Best death.
Oh, God.
It has to be all of them. It's just all of them in Edge of Tomorrow.
Okay, but can we just take a moment and say which one of the deaths is our favorite?
I think the one when he first saves Emily Blunt and he's got, like, the hole in his chest and he can't tell, like, how bad he is. And he's like, I think I'm hit. And she's like, there's a hole in your chest. She's like, really? And he's like, are you taking my ammo? Like, I don't, there's just something so, he's so perplexed because he was expecting help. And I don't think she knows that it's him yet, right? So she's just weirdo? Yeah, like, this guy's just a freak. Like, what is he doing? That, I think, is up there for me. And it's one of the early on ones, too. So I'm, like, not really, like, acquainted with what exactly is going on.
Nick, what about you?
Oh, my favorite is, and it's really kind of weird because it's one that's played straight up for comedy, but it's the one where he first tries to roll under the truck.
Yes.
And gets squished. And then Bill Paxton's reaction is just so beautiful. It's just stunned silence. It's great.
I think someone ADR'd a line and is like, why?
One of the bits of trivia was that Tom Cruise wanted every death to be both funny and horrifying, and I think they pretty much get that most of the time.
Yep.
The point, like, what works well about that death is that it's one of the very few ones that we see people react to, because really in a lot of these places where, like, he might not have actually died immediately at the time that, you know, he gets run over by the Jeep. Like, he might have lied there for a couple minutes or whatever, like, and just, you know, bled out or whatever, right? But, like,
right.
They're all watching him in horror. Like, why did this guy doing push-ups just roll under a car. Like, what is going on? I think I gotta go with, like, just one of the times where just Emily Blunt is so fed up with him and just shoots him almost out of anger. Just, like, I can't deal with you right now. Like, I'll come back to, like, not come back tomorrow, but, like, I'll come back today when you come back to me today. Like, I just can't deal with you right now. Like, this version of me, I'm fed up.
She's great. Like, she is so trigger happy. Like, when they're in the office at the end trying to get, like, the prototype and she just wants to shoot the guy and he's like, would you just wait? Okay, just don't shoot him. All right. Like, you get the sense that, like, she's just so triggered. And then when he loses it because of the blood transfusion, like, her first impulse is to just, like, shoot him in the head. He's like, whoa, I lost it.
I think my second runner-up is one where she's about to shoot him, and he's like, no, I think I'm okay. Oh, hell, just do it.
Yeah. Best line or best freak out? Is there something that Cruise says in this movie that we want to... I feel like the best lines, like, I think the memorable line, to me at least, is come find me when you wake up, but that's not him, that's her. So,
yeah.
Is there something that he says, either in anger, the freak out, or a line that he just delivers normally that we want to nominate as one of the best lines in Cruise's career?
Never wear one. It's a distraction.
Yeah, that's a good one, because the one I said about, like, even the dead guy, that's like a whole setup punchline, kind of. It's not just him talking. So I think, yeah, just for strictly him, that's a good one. And it's so, like, it just, oh man, it just fits him at that moment so well too.
Best sex scene? No, there are none. Most athletic feat? Is there something that Tom Cruise, the actor, does, not the character? I mean, he did all his own stunts. Is there something in this movie that he does athletically? I mean, just maneuvering around in the suit, maybe, but, like...
But then everybody on set did that, right? Like, everyone right. wearing one went through it. So is there anything he specifically, we'd say, like...
I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't think this deserves to be nominated for this, but I did quite like... There was... when he gets to the dam and has to, like, skirt under a piece of concrete and stuff, there was something about it. Like, I know that floor is padded. I know it, but this looks... wildly painful, everything that he's doing. And so it's like a really good stunt, like a really good solid stunt, and he sold it well. But yeah, I don't think it deserves to get nominated, but I do like it. I think it's very good.
Best running scene. I think we talked about before that there's a lot of running, but there's not like a running scene, right? Like there's not like a highlight of his athleticism there, is there?
I don't think so.
No, there's a couple like cool slow-mo shots of him running. There's that one funny running gag where he keeps trying to save the fat guy on the beach that gets crushed by the drop ship. Like, and then the final time he just kind of like looks over his shoulder like whatever.
Yeah. Best or worst love story? No, like I think that what works about this movie is that there isn't a love story. One of the things that works about this movie is that there isn't really a love story. There's like the chemistry, but they're almost by the nature of the story not able to have a love story.
No, it's camaraderie is what develops. Yeah. It's not, and I, maybe that's why my brain keeps phasing out that kiss, just like nope, doesn't belong.
It's so great, like this movie proves like you could have all this stuff, all this platonic stuff, and you could call it all this and you don't have to throw romance in there to boot, you know, like let's just, you know, like it's totally fine. Like we don't have to have them get together in every movie. It's great when they don't. Right. Yeah.
And then best ensemble cast or best non-Cruise actor, male or female, gotta do Emily Blunt for sure. And then
oh God, yeah.
Best ensemble cast too, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Well, big enough?
Or maybe not enough screen time, because it is like 60% him, 30%. Well, maybe like 50% him, 40% her, 10% everybody else.
I feel like if this was the movie without the resetting, if this was just the we're gonna independence, it's the Battle LA, right? If this was Battle in LA, which is kind of like the similar thing at the time, which is why that movie's excruciatingly boring, you know, and we have Bill Paxton developing and all this stuff, but these characters kind of stay in place for the most part, except for Cruise, which I think is really cool, which helps highlight his change more. So I don't know that they're really there. I mean, they're there to support, but I don't know. It's a tough call.
No, they're a supporting cast. It's not an ensemble. You're right. Okay. Classic ensemble, you know, Aliens is an ensemble where it's all of these characters are working together and all of these actors are working together. Yeah. It's not just, you know, our two stars and then a bunch of really good character actors.
Yeah, fair enough.
Every time I see Bill Paxton now, it just breaks my heart. I just want him to be making more movies. And I have to remember that he's passed on, and it's hurtful.
In better news and happier news, 8 nominations, best film, best role, most badass role, best vehicle chase race, best outfit wardrobe, best death, best line, and best non-Cruise actor female.
I mean, Joey, this is the pinnacle of what Cruise has been doing the entire time, which is dying and coming back to life. Like this is like a thesis film for students of Tom Cruise.
Deaths without consequence, but with consequence. It's a very weird thing. So, Mike, like I said, today, as this comes out, also out The Terminal. Next Friday, the two episodes we have coming out is The Polar Express on Hank's Memories. And then on this feed, we have Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. So to go from this movie to that movie, hashtag blessed. Man, like we've got like six more movies left, and I love two of them.
Well, the Mummy's really coming up. I know you just stopped yourself short because you looked at the list and you're about to say, I love them all, but you saw the Mummy.
Well, so we have Rogue Nation, which I love. We have Jack Reacher Never Going Back, which I like. We have the Mummy, which we will cover. We have American Made, which I really like. We have Fallout, which I love. And then, you know, whenever at some point we're going to have Top Gun 2 and stuff, and like, we're, you know, I'm getting a little wistful for coming to the end. Like, as much as I want to, I love Cruise Club. Like, I wish that he was the one with 60 movies as opposed to Hanks. Like, I'm not going to litigate that here, but oh boy, we've got so many more Hanks movies and so few of them I'm looking forward to.
I think you even knew that. Like, I was shocked how earlier we were going to finish with Cruise than Hanks. Like, I just never bothered to look, I guess, but it just never occurred to me either that he's got so many less movies. But I mean, you know, we're still going to have a bunch of good Hanks for the memories coming up. I know Cloud Atlas is a big one for both of us, so at least we got that on the horizon.
And I found out in this episode that Emily Blunt is in Charlie Wilson's War, so she'll be back on Hanks for Memories.
Cool.
Before too long, so very excited about that. But yeah, some things, really good things coming up. We still got a couple more Toy Story movies. We got Cloud Atlas. There's other stuff that's good that's coming. It's just Cruise Club is like the gift that keeps on giving, and Hanks and Memories is like just like a swift kick in the dick sometimes.
Well, I feel like, I mean, like, I only celebrate Christmas, but it feels like Cruise Club is Christmas morning, and Hanks for the Memories is like Hanukkah, maybe, where there's 8 days, and not every day you get, like, the best gift. Maybe you get, like, 5 out of 8 really cool gifts
or something.
Oh,
I was thinking more like it's, like, the day after Christmas, where, like, you have some nice toys, but you're also like, oh, man, like, Christmas isn't going to come for another 11 months and 4 weeks, and, like, ugh. Like, it's still, like, you're merry. It's the season, but it's not, like, it's not the good part.
We've got different metaphors, but the same feelings behind them, I feel like.
Oh, boy.
It is so bizarre to me. It is so bizarre how Tom Cruise can be making so many movies, but they're all quality movies, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's not making direct-to-video Nick Cage style.
Right.
You know, it's so bizarre to me that he's doing as much as he's doing at such a high level. And it's weird too, because Tom Cruise is also working at an extraordinarily high level, just not as often.
It's weird too that I saw that Hanks even has a direct-to-video movie at all. I was like, whoa, wow, that's insane to me to even consider. Yeah, just that I think Joey and I were both a little like surprised, to be honest with you, when we were like, all of these movies are awesome. Like, what is going on? I had no idea that it was going to be like this good.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining us. I think this is a series wrap for you, at least as of now, on the Tom Club. So there are 100 episodes of your podcast, Real Bad, for people to listen to. But is there anywhere else online that you want people to find you?
You can find me at Twitter, at NG Jenkins, if you want to, I don't know, keep up with my shenanigans, which are, you know, it's a 43-year-old dude's shenanigans, so it's not much shenanigans, but...
Plus corgis.
And if you want to follow me on Instagram just to get a lot of corgi pictures, you can do that. I'm at NG Jenkins there.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And Mike, like I said, next week we got Rogue Nation, which is very good, and we got Polar Express, which, question mark, but I'm assuming not as good as Rogue Nation. But what if it's better than Rogue Nation? Who knows?
I don't know. I'll eat my hat.
But for all things Cruise Club and Hanks for the Memories and Real Bad and all 27 shows here on the Cage Club Podcast Network, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, run@cageclub.me. Still looking for an award show name, so if you have an idea, email it in. We'll come back next week for Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Check out Hanks and the Memories today. Check out High School Slumber Party today. Check out our Nothing But Time episode of Too Fast, Too Forever today. Fridays are truly for fun now that we've got 4 episodes we're releasing every Friday. Hashtag quarantine. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Nick Jenkins. We'll see you next time right here on Cruise Club.